When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Supernatural Circumstances, the podcast where we take you down the rabbit hole into the fantastic world of the strange, the paranormal, and the unknown. I'm Morgan Knudsen.
And I'm Mike Brown. It's time to dim the lights and settle in. Come along with us on this week's adventure. Holy smokes.
Yeah.
More UFOs, and I love it.
Yeah, this, I think, is probably one of the most unique stories I have heard in a really long time. And when this came to my attention through the amazing Dr. Dean Bertram, who we've had on before, talking about the UAP hearings and all of that kind of a thing. And he said, you guys have to read this book. And I was like, okay, no problem. And there's very few people that have blown my mind, like completely blown my mind and really made me rethink the world. And this one did it.
We're going to be talking to Chris Aubeck. And Chris is the author of a book called Saucers, Tracing the Origins of Disc-Shaped UFOs. And it's really interesting how he talks about this. And we'll get into it with his conversation. But like, why does the term flying saucer appear everywhere?
Yeah.
Why is that a thing? Is that what people were seeing? Chris says maybe not.
It's super interesting. And what I find so incredible about this subject is it not only applies to UFOs, but this applies, I think, to every topic that we think we know about the world. You know, what is it that we actually know? How much of it is shaped by other people's opinions, by the media, by our environment, our culture, all of those things?
And
that is what I find very interesting about this.
I agree. And Chris, he has a bit of a pedigree. He did a book with one of the most famous ufologists, Jacques Vallée.
Yeah.
Another book called Wonders in the Sky. And Jacques Vallée, for those who don't know, there's a French character in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and it's played by the famous director François Truffaut, who was a friend of Steven Spielberg. Well, that character is based on Jacques Vallée. So, you know, it's really cool that we're a couple of degrees of separation from that, you know, Close Encounters even.
Totally. Because, I mean, if you don't know the story, I think of, you know, UFOs, or you're not incredibly, you know, into that subject or whatever, most people have seen Close Encounters. You know, it's such a iconic film. And
if you haven't seen it, go watch it. I'm not kidding. I watch it at least once a year. I love it.
It's brilliant. It's brilliant. And it was so just paradigm shifting when it came out that I think it's a must see. I mean, it's definitely about the people. It's about our relationship with these things. It's really, really neat.
Well, let's talk to Chris.
I'm ready. Oh, it is so good to start this conversation. You know, like we were just talking about off air, is that there's so much out there and so much conflicting information and so many things that are constantly, especially in the last year or so, pouring out of the media. Chris, it is really good to have you here today. Thank you so much for coming and talking about this.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Dean Bertram, who is a mutual friend of ours, I mean, he was so fascinated with your work, and we knew we had to talk to you too, because your books are so interesting, and I love that you've dug further, I think, than just the surface level of this strange topic. What was it about this question that made you write a book on it, this idea of tracing the origins back as far as you have?
Okay, well, of course, we can talk about any of the 9 or 10 books that I've published I started.
True.
I mean, most of them have to do with the history of the topic, because, of course, most of us know about what's happened since 1947, since June the 24th, 1947, when Kenneth Arnold saw his 9 mysterious objects flying over Mount Rainier. But what happened before that? That's the interesting thing, because, of course, it's been a media circus since that date. Everyone and their grandmother knows about UFOs, flying saucers, little greys, and so on and so forth. So the important thing is to look back at a time before all of these subjects became mainstream, before this imagery had a chance to settle in the collective consciousness, as it were, of society. Because, of course, if you can find patterns in the data before 1947, it's more likely that it's indicative of strange phenomena, or at least, I mean, because there would have been much less contamination, cross-contamination between media outlets, because, of course, particularly on a global scale, if you find a story about a weird light in the sky with a red cross in it in the center of Africa, for example, and then you find the same thing in China and in New York, it's very unlikely that each of those locations would have known about each other, and it's more probable that you know that there's actually something there, or that they actually saw something. So, I've always been interested in the ancient history side of this, in the folklore, because really folklore, half the time is just our own interpretation of things that we've seen that we haven't been able to understand, and how we've expressed it using archetypal imagery or poetical ideas or just in, you know, theological language too.
This is kind of what you tackled in your book, Wonders in the Sky, with Jacques Vallée, is that correct?
Yeah, well, in Wonders in the Sky, that was a different time in my life, but I still, of course, support the whole notion behind that book. We tried to find 500 interesting, good cases, UFO cases, and put them together chronologically. And we do say in the introduction that book is basically just a draft. It's a first attempt to rebuild our lost UFO past, and we would need to rewrite it at some point, which we did. A few years later, we made a different version. We got rid of lots of cases. We added some new ones. We've corrected errors. And it's still a work in progress as far as I'm concerned. I want to bring out my own version probably in the first few months of 2024. And it's the idea is to see if we can identify patterns in the data. If the ancient Greeks, for example, saw the same thing as the Egyptians or the Romans or in medieval times, and see if that has any resemblance to what people have seen in the 20th and 21st centuries. So, and of course, we do find we do find similarities. We do find patterns, and then there are some areas some aspects which have surprised us. For example, the complete lack of flying saucer-shaped objects before the 20th century. For example, it's and that was the basis for my most recent book on flying saucers, which is simply called Saucers. I wanted to explore that problem. So by looking back at history, we can not only it doesn't only help us interpret what's going on today, it also serves as a kind of warning too, because if we know that something had a fictional origin and today we find exactly the same thing in newspapers, on TV, and so on, what does that mean? It probably means that it's equally fictional today, whatever aspect of the phenomenon that is.
Yeah, that's so interesting that you brought that aspect of it up, because that's one thing, Mike, that you and I have talked about so many times. Yep. on this show, and that we've traced back in so many subject matters is that role of people's belief and what that belief plays and it plays into these stories. And like you were saying, Chris, is the idea of the folklore aspect of this as well. It seems to be something that we can't escape, like no matter what subject matter that we're in, this role of belief that seems to play in, especially into the UFO community, which is oddly enough something that I hadn't, you know, a year or two ago really connected with it. But I think you just bring up a really good point there.
Well, I mean, there's folklore in every single academic branch of science and history, geography. Sure. in every area. If you look at geography, of course, there are very good maps and there are countries and there are freeways and ships exploring the world. But then there are also maps of places that have never existed. Mm-hmm. There are stories and legends of locations that were just invented by people, that were just fruit of somebody's imagination. So even in the world of geography, which we can all touch and travel around, there's folklore there, and we have to bear that in mind. I think it's important in the world of UFOs, where very little has been established as true, that we need to not fall into the trap of believing any old thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
as we question those things, it might be painful to some people, because that's one of the reasons I don't have too many friends in this field. I mean,
fair enough.
People respect what I'm doing. They buy my books, they read it, they learn a lot, it makes them think. But then I question things that they've probably held dear for decades and they don't mm-hmm. want to let go of. And, yeah, you know, that's the thing. As I said in the latest book that I've published called Sources, I question the whole existence of disc-shaped craft, because if you look at modern databases or even older databases, the number of sightings of disc-shaped objects, saucer-shaped objects, is incredibly small. We're talking about a tiny fraction. In fact, we're looking at 2%, 1%, 4%, 5%. And that's all. 95 to 99% of cases have nothing to do with discs, but then it's the disc that we use to decorate books and posters and jewelry and stickers, and it's what Bart Simpson's going to encounter
right,
on his
yeah.
adventures. And so the disc has become synonymous with UFOs, but it's paradoxical, because really discs are incredibly underrepresented in the data. It's mainly about spheres and triangles and rectangles and any shape under the sun except discs. So what I like to do is to question everything.
Sure. I think that's the healthy way to look at everything, really. I mean, especially if you're exploring something that you're not really sure even exists, the best thing to do is to question everything that you learn or see.
Yeah, and you bringing up the idea of the saucers and just that tiny percentage. You talk a lot about Kenneth Arnold in Saucers, and his experience. And for the audience, he was an aviator. And in June 1947, he ended up seeing these crafts. And he was really, I think, one of the first people to talk about the idea that this was almost like a half moon pie shaped, half a pie mm-hmm. dish kind of shape. But that seemed to be the kickoff for some of this stuff. Is that right?
Yeah, it's a lot more complex than what people believe. And what I've done with this book is the first thing I did, I decided to fill it with pictures and diagrams, illustrations and fun things and comical looking things. But because people don't like reading about history,
right.
And people who are into UFOs, they don't want to have to do any hard work to get at the information half the time. So what I did was to make a book that's quite entertaining to read. But then what I've done is to piece together Arnold's own statements about what he saw. The first ever adjective he used to describe the shape of the objects was somewhat bat-shaped.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first thing he said. He didn't say that they were discs. He didn't say that they looked like saucers. He said they were somewhat bat-shaped. And the reason why he chose the word bat was because at that time, in the mid to late 40s, even earlier too, the most popular aircraft, because at that time people were actually fascinated by aviation, but I mean just normal people in the street, farmers and shopkeepers and barmen were interested in the latest technological developments in the world of aviation. So
sure.
there were celebrity aircraft which appeared in newspapers mm-hmm. in the same way that the Kardashians might be
right
today.
Yep.
At that time, people were comparing a craft called the Flying Wing, an airplane designed by Northrop, the engineers, originally to be used in World War II, but it was never deployed. They were comparing it with bats, and the word bat was strongly associated with these aircraft that looked boomerang shaped. So when Kenneth Arnold told reporters that he had seen a bat-shaped object, or a bat, well, he said somewhat bat-shaped, he had that in mind. He was talking about this single-winged craft. And then when he came to talk about it in the next few interviews, he said it looked like a half moon. But then it seems that he was implying a crescent. He was talking about half a plate, which is a semicircular. But then the famous picture that he made in 1950, an airbrush drawing that today his daughter Kim Arnold has at home, shows very much a crescent-shaped object. So at the beginning, he didn't understand why everybody was reporting saucer shapes, because that's not what he had seen. But
right.
he had obviously triggered the craze. So he was really confused about what was going on.
It is confusing. What do you make of it? Was this something that the media just designed and kind of threw in there? Like, where was this turning point?
Yeah, so about 20 years ago, I was doing some deep research into the origin of the expression flying saucer, and I discovered that the expression had been invented around the year 1881. It wasn't invented in 1947. It was 60 years old by then, more than 60 years old. And, that's on the one hand, and I'll return to that point. But what happened was that William Beckett, the journalist who interviewed Arnold at length at the Pendleton Hotel, he got the adjective somewhat bat-shaped, and that went into his original article. Arnold also said that they were flat like pie pans. and like saucers. But at that time, as flat as a saucer was the same as saying as flat as a pancake today.
Right.
It doesn't imply that something's round. It just means it's very flat. And so in the book, I actually give several examples of people at that time using the expression as flat as a saucer, as flat as a pie plate. But even referring to the collar of a woman's coat or, I don't know, a face or feet, because it didn't necessarily mean disc-shaped. So what happened was that this journalist mentioned the flat as a saucer and so on in his article, and he also wrote somewhat bat-shaped. But when he made a version of this article for the Associated Press, which would mean that it would appear in all of the newspapers all across the country,
right,
he forgot to use the adjective somewhat bat-shaped. He forgot, or he omitted it, or he didn't want to write it, or I don't know. So what that meant was that everybody in the country received a version of that interview, a version of that article, that omitted the only shape expression that Kenneth Arnold had used, somewhat bat-shaped, and they only visualized saucers and pie pans. So that was where the idea of flat, circular UFOs came from. However, the important point, to return to this, but to the fact that flying saucer was an expression invented in the 1880s, this was an expression that was created to describe clay pigeons used in mm-hmm. trap shooting and skeet. Because although these days we've totally forgotten, for the first few decades of the 20th century, skeet and trap shooting were incredibly important sports in North America, up there with tennis and golf and everything else. They were really, really important sports. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands and possibly millions of people played these sports for several decades. And they had used the expression flying saucer to describe these clay targets for generations. So when in 1947, journalists had heard about this guy, Kenneth Arnold, who'd seen things that were like pie pans or saucers, they all independently invented the expression flying saucer, but they just borrowed it from the vocabulary that already existed. So we can't really say that anybody invented the word, the expression flying saucer, to describe Arnold's UFOs. It was just already a part of the language. And that's how it spread so quickly, because everyone knew what a flying saucer looked like. It was used in trap shooting. But then, if I can just say, there's one last piece of the puzzle, which is fascinating too. In the mid-1940s, the sport was abandoned officially because the government and the military wanted to dedicate all ammunition and weapons that had been used in this sport to the war effort for World War II. So nobody could use bullets and rifles and things for trap shooting. They were all given to the military. But the military said, well, we're going to hire the best marksmen who've been firing at these clay pigeons or flying saucers for years to train our own gunners, so they're ready to fight the Nazis flying over Europe or over Germany. And so for several years, the American military used the expression flying saucer and used it in their training programs to train their own soldiers to fight the Nazis and so on. And in newspapers just a couple of years before Kenneth Arnold's sighting, the military was saying, well, we're using flying saucers to train our best men. And curiously, the man in charge was a guy called General Arnold. And so in the space of 3 years, people associated first General Arnold with the use of flying saucers to train gunners. And then 3 years later, people associated Kenneth Arnold with his flying saucers and then alien spaceships. So it's a very interesting period in American history that anyone who loves flying saucers or UFOs in general should really know about.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It's just it's interesting too, you know, as you're telling the story, how you can see how the public was connecting the dots, you know, between even maybe when they shouldn't have been connecting the dots, but they were connecting these dots, and how this developed. It's so interesting. And then there was in 1946, I thought this was really interesting as well, that in San Diego, which was right before Kenneth Arnold's sighting, there was another object in the sky during a meteor shower, and people were describing it as like a bullet shape and with mm-hmm. wings and a vapor trail and whatnot. I thought that was interesting that the flying saucer label didn't seem to get strapped to that sighting.
Well, exactly, because there hadn't been that confusion caused by the journalist who'd only used the word saucer to describe sure. flatness. Nobody talked about flat UFOs before Kenneth Arnold's sighting. And so, I mean, the fact that it's a bullet's interesting, that they described this object flying over San Diego as bullet-shaped, because, I mean, there is this sort of cultural obsession in the United States with bullets right, and yeah. firing guns and so on. So it's interesting in that sense, yeah. I suppose. But the fact is that nobody associated that object with saucers, because nobody had even dreamt of the possible. Well, they had dreamt in fiction, but nobody had even tried to design a vehicle that was round and flat. That flew through the sky, because of course everyone knew that these things had to spin at incredible speeds to remain aloft. That I mean, nobody imagined that a real alien spaceship would look like that.
Sure, yeah, and I mean, even the you know, the idea of, or I guess the interest of more futuristic technologies as the war's coming about and things like, I mean, that had to have played a big part too. The idea that, you know, they're developing these new things and you know, these ideas are running through people's heads. Like when we see it in film era at that time, and, you know, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and the, you know, all these different movies and whatever not that, that came out that were so impactful to people's imagination. Like it's fascinating how the culture is so integrated into, you know, how people are envisioning these things. Because we go back, like even in your book, you were talking about history back as far as 400 BC in the Vedas in India. And the idea of, you know, human souls reaching the moon and all of these amazing things, but they were all at that point all seen as these celestial events. You know, the idea of these more futuristic things weren't in play at that point, which I thought was really, really interesting, how there seems to be almost a line between when this started versus how people were interpreting it and even how they were visualizing it back in you know, China and India and France and all of these places.
Well, what I do in Alien Artifacts and this series of books, I thought it was going to be three, but it might end up being four because it's such a fascinating and huge story, the origin of ufology and our belief in visiting extraterrestrials. What I do at the beginning of Alien Artifacts is that I trace our humanity's belief in other planets, other civilized planets, back to the ancient Greeks. They had a philosophy called atomism. They believed that the universe was composed of atoms, and this was a long time before microscopes, obviously, and that they thought that these swirling atoms probably replicated the same patterns across the universe, and if that were true, then as there are people on the Earth, then the same atoms would form people on other planets in the universe. So the idea of an inhabited planets does go back to the ancient Greeks. But and in the book I show how this grew over the centuries, and when you get to medieval times, it was debated even among the medieval theologians. It was a very important topic, in fact, among Christian philosophers. If anyone's interested in the history of Christianity and how they perceive and how Christians have traditionally perceived the universe, this book is a very good guide because it shows how the whole, I mean, the church used to have a philosophical problem, and that was if God had created a universe full of inhabited planets, which what people actually thought in medieval times, did Jesus Christ die on every one of those planets? Did God sacrifice mm-hmm. his only son on every planet? Or are we living in a universe full of sinners? If not, did the original sin happen everywhere, or maybe nowhere apart from our own planet? It's a massive problem. And then lots of philosophers said, well, maybe Jesus just traveled from one planet to the next, spreading news about God and religion. And in a sense, that turns him into a space traveler. If he did that, he would be hopping from galaxy to galaxy. So, I mean, it's interesting looking back at medieval books and how they envisioned this kind of thing, alien worlds and contact between them and so on. But then we only really find stories or claims of contact with aliens in the 19th century. From the very beginning of the 19th century, we begin to see how people could believe in extraterrestrials visiting the Earth, bringing technology with them, bringing learning with them, and so on, which is an idea that we find again in the 1950s in the contactee movement. And then it was around 1857 that the first story about a UFO was published and interpreted as extraterrestrial visitors. So, I mean, it's such a vast subject, and I think my book, Alien Artifacts, is the only real guide to it that's ever been published, and that's why everyone's encouraging me to publish the next ones as quickly as possible. They want to know how it all happened.
The Alien Artifacts is from antiquity to 1880, and your other books will cover other things from 1880 on. Is that correct, or will it revisit that era?
Yeah. Well, my original plan was for Alien Artifacts 2. To cover from 1880 to 1896, which would be the beginning of the great airship wave in North America, when people saw mysterious airships all over the United States. And the thing is that so many people have written to me with their own findings about strange alien visits and encounters and what have you from the 1860s, 1870s, that I'm going to have to take a step back, I think, and and add a few things from previous decades. So this is the great thing about publishing through Amazon. It gives authors a lot of freedom to play around with their manuscript, to make a revised version, to update it, and so on. That's why I think the next few books will be published through Amazon too.
Well, it's given people like authors, people like you and Mike, and I think such an advantage, and especially in such an ever-changing field like this one. I mean, even in the last, 6 months, there has been so much that's just poured into the public's eye. And Mike and I were talking about this just before you got here, Chris, about the idea of people seem to be, even as this stuff is being introduced and they're making these gigantic claims, like the hearings, the Mexican hearings, and we see the congressional hearings and so on and so forth. And it seems like, at least to us, like people are becoming fatigued of the claims that are coming out, because they're not hitting the news. It's not causing the uproar that it did in the 50s. It's almost like people are passing this by. Do you think that maybe, like, there's sort of a gut instinct that people know that something's not right with some of this stuff?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, on the one hand, we have the fact that every generation has its equivalent of the idea that the government is just about to tell us all of its dark secrets. You know, I mean, if you look at old UFO bulletins, magazines from the 1940s onwards, it seems that the government's always just about to tell us some terrible truth they're not sure if we can handle.
Yeah.
And it seems that every 5 or 6 years, someone comes out with a new book, some important person, some important military man or politician, about his experience with alien bodies or Roswell, or they know the truth about something or other. And these books are published, or these public figures become famous for 10 minutes, and then everyone forgets about it and moves on and waits till the next one does exactly the same thing again. And I think that if you look at this from a historical perspective, you can't really take it seriously anymore. The other day I found an article from, I believe it was 1883 or 1873, which said that they were sure that at any moment now, humanity was going to experience a massive revelation about our space brothers. And that was 1873.
Sure.
Wow.
You know, we're always on the verge of this thing, and people say, can't you feel it? Can't you sense that it's just about to happen? It doesn't happen. I mean, 100 years later, 150 years later, we're still waiting. And
it's like cult figures saying the world is going to end at this particular day, and then when it doesn't, they're we misread the signs. And
yeah, exactly. Exactly. Like the Seventh-day Adventists. Did that. I mean, it's always like, Jesus Christ is just about to arrive, or sell all your possessions. It's going to be the 14th of October or whatever. And then when that date comes along, they say, oh, it's been changed, divinely changed in the schedule. We have to wait another 6 months. And yeah, it's just a feeling people have. It's a little bit like conspiracy theories. And I'm not saying that conspiracy theories are all nonsense. It's possible that many are totally true in the UFO world. They are in other areas of life. But I mean, the earliest conspiracy theory that I've found is from the 1860s, related to UFOs and whatever. So it's something that we've been dragging with us for years.
They've always been around. I grew up in the 70s and 80s with all the JFK assassination conspiracy theories that were happening then. You know, it's like you say, what is it that you think is driving that? Is it, times are tough and people are looking for something to save them? Is that what this is?
I think that it's the idea that something so big and so important can't have gone unnoticed by the big powers that be, for example, the governments and the and scientific boards and so on. So the only conclusion is that as governments have such a lot of money behind them, they must have already reached conclusions that we mere mortals could not do with our own money and resources. So there's a feeling that they must have information that we don't have. They must have knowledge. They must have whatever. And I think that that's a feeling that we've always had, that the governments or monarchies or politicians and presidents, etc., must have secrets that the rest of us don't have access to. And that must be just a very normal feeling. And I'm sure that if we look at other areas of history, if we could interview Roman soldiers, we'd probably hear that, you know, them saying, "Well, I'm sure the emperor knows exactly what's going on. I'm sure that he has information that we do not have as mere soldiers," and they would have been right, of course, too. So it's not an unnatural feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it makes so much sense, and I'm just revisiting a quote from a fellow by the name of Dr. Brett Weinstein, who he's a biologist, and this quote caught me, and I copied it down because I thought it was just relevant for so many things going on in the world, especially this. And the quote is, "And so the point is not really, are you a conspiracy theorist or are you not? The question is, are you any good at it? Are you good at being rigorous in the confusing landscape where collusion may be taking place? And it's not easy, because frankly, the nature of conspiracy is to create a phony story, which then causes Occam's razor to trigger artificially. So how do you tell the difference between an organically simple explanation for something and a phony baloney simple explanation that effectively obscures the truth? That's the difficulty philosophically."
Yeah, that's true, isn't it? I mean, how can we distinguish? It's very, unless you're personally involved in whatever's going on, there is no way. I mean, you know, whether Apple products become obsolete because it's programmed into the Apple schedule or whatever. It's all sounds so realistic too, and likely, and it can't all be true. So, you know, there must be a lot of it that isn't true. And I'm pretty sure that again, the powers that be, whoever they are, have manipulated us many times in the past, because they know that we'll reach that conclusion, or either on our own or with a little bit of prodding. So I suppose it's a kind of propagandist machine without actually making propaganda. I'm not sure. But the case I have, for example, from the 1860s was an Australian. It happened in Australia. It was, I believe he was Welsh or Irish, an engineer in a place called Parramatta in Australia. He had a vision. He was an engineer, very important engineer, called Frederick William Birmingham. And he had a vision of an airship that landed just outside his house. And or he had a vision, or he experienced it, or dreamt it, whatever happened. And then he felt that he was being floated through the air. He landed inside this vehicle. There was a strange being that showed him the workings of it, even showed him a mathematical formula which he had to remember. And then this guy probably woke up in his bed, or it was the next day, and then he spent decades trying to rebuild the flying machine from his vision. And he believed he'd successfully designed it, and he went from Australia to North America and tried to get financial backing, tried to get people interested. No one was particularly interested, but apart from that, he was fired from his job by Queen Victoria's government. And then he reached the conclusion that it was Queen Victoria's government who'd fired him from this job to stop his blueprints for a flying machine to fall into enemy hands. So this is a conspiracy theory, because he thought that the British government was against him and had put all these obstacles in his way just to stop him from ever commercializing this idea. And I mean, it's just something that's been with us all this time. And of course, I'm sure that that wasn't the case. I don't think Queen Victoria had any idea that this man even existed. But it's just a natural human instinct to believe that that authorities have more information and secrets than we do. And of course they do, but it doesn't mean they're right about them. It doesn't mean they have the secrets we'd like them to have.
Yeah, of course. What do you think at the end of all of this, and because you've delved into this to such an incredible degree, what do you think people are really seeing?
I don't know. I don't know what I saw. On the 6th of April, 1996, I had my UFO sighting. I was in a small village in Spain called Talarrubias, and I saw an orange rectangular luminous thing in the sky. I was with a group of people. I think there were six or seven of us. And we were all looking at it, and it didn't make any sense. And people were like inventing all kinds of explanations. They were saying, oh, that's a satellite. And of course, satellites didn't look like that. Oh, that's just a secret aircraft. But they wouldn't have been experimenting with a weird objects like that over this particular area mm-hmm. in Spain.
Sure.
So I saw something, and I can't explain it, and I've looked for an answer for it. I don't know. I just hope they're not here to eat us.
Right. know. Well, according to Joe Simonton from April 18th, 1961, they're here to feed us pancakes. You're probably aware of that story.
That's right. Yeah. And maybe they've achieved their goal. I don't know. Maybe something that we're eating all the time. They invented it. Who knows? But
perhaps.
Well, the IHOPs aren't doing very well in Alberta.
I feel sort of uncomfortable to say they or refer to the intelligences or whatever, because I think that would be to anthropomorphize something that might not be crude or manned or full of people in any sense. You know, I mean, we don't know what's inside these objects, or even if they're objects at all half the time. And it sort of depends to what extent you believe eyewitness testimony and whether they really were eyewitnesses. I mean, it's such a confusing area.
Right.
And the more we have mobile phones and the more connected we all are, the fewer close encounters seem to happen. So
well, that's because they screw with the technology and no one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is it. I mean, at what point do people start saying, "Yeah, I don't think that's what's happening after all"? I mean, the thing is, what I do in my book Sources, I point out the fact that although we all associate UFOs with flying discs, and we're all aware that UFOs have existed for thousands of years. Flying discs have had a very short history, but so short. I compare it, I believe, to the career of the Rolling Stones, because it's just a few decades. That's all it's been. It was the 1940s, 1950s, and 60s. But then when we get into the 80s, late 70s, 80s, it's not really about discs anymore. It's all kinds of shapes, all kinds of weird phenomena were happening. But we still drag the image of a disc, you know, with us, and I don't know. It's such a complex thing.
It really is.
Yeah, it reminds me actually of the course that I was taking, a bunch of academics and myself. In once a year, we get together for this amazing course called the Paramook. And it's run by the Parapsychology Foundation, and basically all the minds would come and get together and talk about research and the latest research and stuff. And the one fellow, and his name escapes me right now, but his area of research was abductions and sleep paralysis. And what I found so interesting about his research and what he brought to light was that the descriptions of the aliens and the creatures themselves, you'd think that they would be very universal, and they weren't. They were very culturally influenced and culturally isolated, where in the West we had the grays. In South America, people were reporting sort of more animal-looking creatures, and which was very much in touch with the spirituality of that area. And Europe, you kind of had something different. And I thought that was just really, really interesting. And it just, as we're talking about this idea of the flying saucer and the shape and how it's being influenced in these certain ways, that keeps coming back to me, is that so much of this seems to have this, you know, this interpretation, or that we're dealing the interpretation through our own perceptions to some degree. And it's so important, I think, that we recognize how much of what we are perceiving is so influenced by you know, where we live, where we're at culturally, spiritually, you know, all of these things. It's amazing how it's just all integrated. But it's something I think everybody needs to be aware of.
Yeah, and I mean, apart from that, people make a big effort to show that UFOs have always been with us. It's hard to know exactly why that's such an obsession. But if you go on the internet and you look for UFOs, ancient history, you'll find a lot of very, very fake pictures of sculptures, Egyptian hieroglyphics, Mayan hieroglyphics, and so on, showing saucers and greys, as if they've always been with us for some reason. But in actual fact, when you start, and this is when I start losing friends in this field, and
right.
This is where I have to start looking through the window and I'm thinking, I don't know, what are they gonna do to me?
Yeah.
But when we look at sources, we find that it was like 30, maybe 40 years that they were dominant in the field. They didn't exist before 1947. There are very few cases. And very few cases these days, too. And that's not me saying that. That's the data. And then greys only started appearing in the very early 1980s. And before that, they weren't there at all. They were gray-skinned creatures, plus all kinds of colors. There were tall and dwarfish and thin and fat creatures. But you didn't find the exact combination of dwarfish with gray skin and giant eyes until the 1980s. But people make a massive effort to make sort of AI-generated pictures or just sculptures or whatever showing discs and grays in antiquity. And that's something that I say in the book. I say, well, look, I'm not saying that UFOs don't exist. I'm not saying that weird creatures don't exist. But let's just step back and think about what we're really saying here. Is this actually true? Or are we just falling victims to our own culture? And that's it. I mean, but when I tell people about the greys not really existing more than 40 years ago, they're not very happy about it. And if I say that flying saucers didn't really exist before 1947, people start switching off. And that's why I had to write this book. I knew not a lot of people were going to read it, actually, because the moment I start talking about it in an interview, they're going to say, oh, that's not true. You know, if that can't be true.
Yeah.
And they're not going to read it. But you just need to face this kind of information sometimes, you know?
Well, I just ordered it, so I am definitely going to read it.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, this is the conversation that I want to have. I don't want to have the conversation with people who are staunch believers in something and just say, I know it's this, and there's no room for you to tell me anything else other than these are beings from reticuli, blah, 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 and they're in flying saucers. That's that's all I want to hear. And to me, that makes the conversation impossible. I mean, how are we going to have a conversation about what these things are if you already believe that they are something that perhaps they're not?
Exactly. I mean, if we were zoologists or botanists or, you know, or just cooks, or I don't know, it should make us feel ashamed to say we already know what these things are, even if we don't have one in the laboratory. I mean, you know, to reach these conclusions so quickly would be a shameful thing in any other study. But in ufology, it seems that the belief exists first, and then they just look for the facts after that.
Right.
Back that up. And they will find them because there'll be other people who believe the same things as them, and they'll end up reading imaginative narratives that, you know, that aren't really, really true at all. So, it's, for example, the topic of ancient aliens, or when I was younger, it was called ancient astronauts, but they don't say that these days. That's something that's always interested me. When I got into this field, I was about 13, 14, 15, and I became a member of the Ancient Astronaut Society, which is in Illinois, and it was run by Eric von Däniken's lawyer at the time, Gene Phillips.
I was just going to invoke his name,
and he died a few years ago, well, several years ago now, I imagine, but I became very interested in this topic, and I believed, as everybody else did, that this was something that had been invented in the mid 20th century, because as we'd become more technological and aware of the universe, we were starting to reinterpret ancient legends with space age eyes or whatever, and it all made lots of sense. But then over the years, I pieced together the origins of the ancient astronaut theory, and it comes from 1823. I know the name of the man who invented it, the reason how he reached that conclusion. I know the evidence he used, and I know the date. I could probably even give them the month and the year. I mean, everything. It comes from the year 1823, which means that this is the 200th anniversary of the ancient astronaut hypothesis. I don't know if we should go out and celebrate, but this is, you know. He was a French author called Chabrier, who wrote a book that tried to explain some rocks that he'd found in Germany during one of his business trips there. And at that time, people were talking about the asteroids that had been discovered in the last decade of that period, and many people had reached the conclusion that the asteroids had been part of an inhabited planet, and the reason that they thought that it had been inhabited was that why would God destroy a planet unless it had been full of sinners? So there were lots of people thinking that a planet had been destroyed, creating the asteroid belt, and if God had allowed that to happen, he must have had a really good reason for it. Anyway, this guy thought that maybe these strange rocks that looked out of place had come from that exploded planet. And then he said, well, if these rocks have reached Earth, maybe remnants of the civilization on that planet have also come here, have also fallen here. And then he started thinking, well, that explains a lot of our mythology. It explains perhaps how the Egyptians got their civilization and so on and so forth. He reached the conclusion that our ancestors had either been or been visited by or come into contact with extraterrestrials from this forgotten planet that had become the asteroids. And this idea became very popular over the next few decades. And by the 1860s, 1880s, writers were already talking about the pyramids having been designed or built by people from other planets. The Easter Island statues were tied in with this too. And we're talking about 100 years before von Däniken wrote about it. And that's the origin of the ancient alien theory. And this is actually several chapters in my book, Alien Artifacts. Some of the discoveries that I've made and I've published, I mean, people read them and they write to me and they say, oh my God, I've been talking about ancient aliens all my life and right. I had no idea. In 1870, this guy called Dufresne in Paris, the French were very interested in this theory, as they were in North America too. A guy called Dufresne made a presentation to a very important intellectual group in Paris, saying that he believed that the continent of Australia had fallen from space as an asteroid and landed in the Pacific Ocean. And that would explain why the Aborigines are so weird, he said, because there were extraterrestrials. That would explain why there were koalas and kangaroos and so on, because it wasn't they're not from this planet. They're all alien species. He also said that because no one's come to collect this planet, no one's come to claim it as if it were a tennis ball in someone's backyard, we could colonize it and take it for ourselves.
Oh, jeez.
Therefore justifying the idea of the white of the white race taking this planet from the original native inhabitants and probably turning them into slaves.
Wow.
Yikes. So,
you know, 1870.
Yeah.
The mental gymnastics are incredible.
Well, I could talk to you all day about this, Chris.
Yeah, truly. This has been absolutely amazing, and I really hate the fact that we have to wrap it up, but this is so phenomenal, and I feel like I have had about 10 years education in the last hour. Thank you so much for this. This is phenomenal, and we'd absolutely love to have you back to keep this conversation going, because I know for a fact that if we've never heard it, I think a lot of other people haven't heard it either. And please, everybody, go out and just buy Chris's books, because they're really fantastic. And Chris, where can people get your books and find you? Because I know you're going to get a lot of calls after this.
Right. So I'm publishing them through Amazon. I'm keeping the price as low as I can, too, because I'm more interested in people reading this than, mm-hmm. I don't make a living from this, which is an important difference. People who make a living from this end up saying all kinds of absurd nonsense just to sell books or whatever it is, you know, and that's not what I do. So anyway, if they look for me on Amazon, they look for Alien Artifacts and Sources. Those are the first two books in my re-examination of the history of ufology, and then very soon there'll be several more. I'm the founder and director of a group called Magonia Exchange, which has been operating since April 2003, and we've collected more than 40 or 50,000 cuttings from newspapers, stories completely forgotten about, I mean, cases that no one's ever heard of. It's time to share them, so I want to start a kind of a Fortean source book series, just start sharing everything that we've collected over the years with my comments and observations and so on. So if anyone wants to join that group, just put in Google Magonia Exchange, and then put I think it's IO, which is the name of the company that has our group in it, and they'll find the address very quickly. And then if anyone wants to find me on Facebook or wherever, you know, the usual places, they can do that too. My email is always at the back of my books, so if anyone's interested in buying one, you know, just buy one, read it, return it to Amazon. They'll never know. Steal it, whatever you want. I just want people to read it, that's all, and to see, you know, something real for a change about where all this has come from.
It is so fascinating. Thank you so much, Chris. We really appreciate this.
Thank you very much for having me.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that interview went to places that I wasn't expecting, and it was, I'm so glad we continually have these guests on who, you know, other guests suggest to us, because I wouldn't have known about this guy. I went right out and ordered Chris's book, Saucers, as soon as we had this, while we were having the conversation, I ordered the book.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing, and as I say, I'm walking away from this interview really re-examining what my own paradigms and ideas are about what I just common things, you know, mm-hmm. things that I think are so common, information that I think is just, you know, is just true by default. Mm-hmm. I'm questioning a lot.
Which is good. I think that's kind of the key for learning, is questioning.
Oh, absolutely.
The minute you stop questioning, we're kind of done for.
Well, totally. And what's great to me about what we just heard is the fact that this really is a cautionary tale, because if we apply what happened here with Kenneth Arnold and the sightings and how these different perceptions have been changed and altered over the years, especially in the case of Kenneth Arnold, where it was one misprint mm-hmm. in a media article And the, you know, the media grabs it, takes hold of it, off it goes, and now all of a sudden everybody thinks it's true. And that, to me, is very, it's very, very telling. And I think it's a cautionary tale for what we know now in terms of what we're taking in, what we're reading, all of that kind of a thing.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm still waiting for my alien pancakes, but, you know.
Oh, you still haven't got your pancakes?
No aliens have come and offered me buckwheat pancakes yet. I'm still like, come on, it's time.
It's like
Mike needs some buckwheat pancakes.
It's like waiting for your Hogwarts letter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, you know? That's not going to happen either. So.
But yeah, I'm so fascinated by this subject because, as I say, I'm leaving this conversation more aware of the world and what I'm listening to, and I'm finding myself going back on just information in parapsychology and even in just day-to-day fact about where I think things come from and actually re-examining a lot of things. Like, my brain is exploding right now. You can't hear it, but it is.
I heard it. It made a sound like a
See?
Just a little.
It's a sensitive microphone.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for joining us on this eerie expedition, dear listeners. I guess this one would be more otherworldly, but, you know.
It definitely is. And remember, the line between the natural and the supernatural is often a thin one, if there is one at all.
Right.
Next time, stay curious, friends.
Yeah. Supernatural Circumstances is a co-production of Entity Seeker Paranormal Research and Teachings and Good Egg Studios. This podcast is part of the Curious Cast podcast network. Theme music by Corey Johnson of Catalyst Records in Edmonton, Alberta. You can learn more about Morgan Knudsen at entityseeker.ca and learn more about me, Mike Brown, and listen to my show, Dark Poutine, at darkpoutine.com. Feel free to email the show at supernaturalcircumstances@gmail.com.